Mormons and Muslims, today on The World. Before the election, many Mormons in Utah said they would not vote for Trump. Then they did. Now some Muslims in Salt Lake City are scared.
It was an eye-opening, uneasy feeling, but it makes you wonder who is secretly must be hating you.
Also, more evidence that Russia systematically doped its Olympic athletes, but many Russians still don't believe it.
This doping scandal is seen here as just another indication of how the West hates us. I don't know that you can prove to Russians, per se, that they are guilty of these charges.
Plus, how a cook reacted to the Turk surrender of Jerusalem nearly a century ago.
I don't want your city, I just want some eggs.
That's all ahead today on The World. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. If you're wondering what Donald Trump's priorities will be as president, here's a clue. In a speech today, Trump said one of his first executive actions will order the Labor Department to investigate, quote, visa abuses that undermine U.S. workers, end quote. If confirmed, Trump's choice for Labor Secretary, Andrew Puzder, will have to carry out that order. Puzder is the CEO of a fast food company and is famously against raising the federal minimum wage. On immigration, Puzder seems more nuanced, according to Muzaffar Shishti with the Migration Policy Institute.
He generally favors immigration. He thinks that immigration is good for the economic growth of the country. He's not generally in that wing of the Republican Party, which thinks that immigration is inimical to the society. But I think he also seems to suggest that levels of immigration should be tied to the economic sort of well-being and the strength of the country. So you might see a labor secretary who favors more of an immigration policy that's tied to the skills as against family ties to the United States citizens.
So let's talk about lower-skilled workers who are currently in the United States, specifically undocumented workers. How would they be affected by Mr. Puzder in office?
Well, Mr. Puzder will certainly be one of the voices which will determine what the policy of this administration is going to be with respect to the unauthorized. And he will have an important voice in that. We frankly do not know whether the president-elect is going to come down on that. He started the campaign, his election campaign, by saying that all unauthorized people should be removed. Then he has since nuanced it by saying that our priority is to remove immigrants with criminal histories, and has also indicated that once he's finished focusing on criminal elements, then the rest of the residual population of unauthorized, which would mean, you know, people who don't have criminal records, there should be some method of dealing with them, but potentially would mean giving them some legal status or the other. Mr. Puzder, in his statements in the past, has favored legalization short of citizenship, which may indicate that maybe his coming in position to the administration.
Yeah, I mean, do you know how Puzder kind of sees a connection to jobs like harvesting our fruits and vegetables, and how this could all impact our labor force generally in the United States?
Well, there is one thing he'll have to look at is whether there is any direct competition between immigrants in general, unauthorized in particular, on the labor market. And that may determine his view on whether people should be legalized or not. But more importantly, I think it is going to determine his views on what kind of temporary worker programs we're going to favor in the future. Are we going to have a temporary worker program which applies both to the high skilled and also to the low skilled, or favor one over the other? And that's where we don't know where his views are.
One thing we do know about Puzder is that he's got a background in the fast food industry, which is known for low wages and often no benefits. It's also an industry that employs a lot of immigrants. What do you see his influence from that background doing more generally to the lives of immigrants?
Well, I think both ways. On one hand, he seems to have indicated that immigrants have a role to play in the economic growth of the country. On the other hand, he also seems to be not in favor of increasing the minimum wage. And, you know, in some ways, those two things can be at variance with each other. That if you really want to advance the interest of U.S. workers, then you really have to increase their wage. And if you don't actually increase their wages, then these jobs become unattractive to U.S. workers. And if they become unattractive to U.S. workers, that becomes a magnet for foreign workers to be attracted to them.
Yeah, it sounds like you're saying that there are really two sides to Mr. Puzder, and we may not actually know what he does until he starts doing it.
Exactly. And which of them will take preference in terms of policy agenda?
Muzaffar Shishti with the Migration Policy Institute. Very good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Since the election, there's been a spike in the number of hate crimes reported across the country. That includes cases of harassment and bullying, often targeting immigrants. Many have turned to churches for help coping with all this. The World's Jasmine Garsd recently traveled to North Carolina, where she spent time at an evangelical church grappling with this new reality.
Bendecidos para bendecir. Repite eso conmigo. Soy bendecido.
It's Sunday in Raleigh. Outside, the trees shiver in the winter chill. And in a deserted strip mall, the Evangelical Church of Ciudad de Dios, City of God, starts its worship. It's a young church with a corporate newness. There's a screen for spiritual PowerPoint presentations, but there are also rustic wooden crosses. This congregation is also entirely Latino, mostly immigrant. And today, they're celebrating one.
Lucho, que se hizo ciudadano esta semana, lunes. Okay. Lucho, levanta la mano allá, mira.
Pastor William Zarzola announces that one of the congregants just became a U.S. citizen. And then he discusses what's on everyone's mind these days, the incoming Donald Trump presidency and the future of immigrants in America.
Ciertamente estamos en un tiempo de mucha incertidumbre, no sabemos qué va a pasar.
We are living in uncertain times, says Arzola. We do not know what will happen after January 20th. But I will tell you something you must be sure of, he says. Anyone can go into that White House, but no one is moving God from his throne. His authority remains strong.
Su autoridad sigue vigente.
But post-election, there's another reality here, a rise in racism. In the days after Trump's win, the Southern Poverty Law Center reported nearly 900 incidents of hateful harassment throughout the U.S., many against immigrants. And this has churchgoers like Ariel afraid and considering returning to Mexico, a place he left years ago.
No estoy con miedo, obviamente veo lo que se nos viene.
I'm not scared, he says, but I can see what's coming. This country has always been racist, but Trump, he says, ran on a campaign of hate, racism, and xenophobia. A few weeks ago, Ariel says he was helping a woman cross the street. They were speaking in Spanish, and a white construction worker spit on him. He says he's ready to leave the U.S.
Paciencia.
Patience. That's what Pastor Arzola says when people ask him how to deal with racism. The pastor was called in to break up a fight between a Latino and a neighbor who told him to go back to his country recently.
Yo les digo que tengan paciencia, que tengan un poquito de
Arzola says, don't leave. Don't leave the U.S. He says the worst way to lose a battle is by not fighting it. Arzola, who is from Venezuela himself, also knows that many of his fellow pastors supported Trump. He understands it was a tough election. He himself was torn up as he cast his vote. He asked God for guidance. He won't say who he voted for, but he does say this.
Yo creo que Dios en estos últimos tiempos, Jasmine, está...
I think these days, God is standing in the middle. And he's saying, look, who are you with? Are you with anti-immigration policies or are you with me? Are you with me? Arzola also wonders what comes after patience. What if deportations ramp up, as Trump promises? The church will have to take a stance, Arzola says. I believe that Jesus Christ was the first activist of our modern times, against the system, using your faith for activism. And Jesus, Arzola says, tells us not to forget the poor, the abused, those who have no country. For The World, Jasmine Garsd, Raleigh, North Carolina.
President-elect Trump went after Boeing this week. He called the company out for charging too much to make a couple of new Air Force One airplanes for the White House. Trump put the price tag at $4 billion and called it ridiculously expensive. The White House said it had no idea where Trump got that figure. But the bottom line is, having a presidential plane is always expensive. Just ask the president of Uruguay, Tabaré Vázquez. He wants one, specifically a small, used Hawker 700 private jet built in 1979, a relative bargain at just $1 million. But even that is a luxury, Uruguayan lawmakers say they can't afford. Pablo Zanocchi is a reporter in Montevideo, the capital of Uruguay. So why does the president want a new jet?
Hi, Marco. The reason why he wants a jet, it's the same reason why you and me will want one, right? To get around.
How do you know I want one?
Well, I'm not sure if you want one, but I'm pretty sure that you don't like the lines in the airports, and I don't like those lines either, you know? So the president wants an airplane for that reason, and he went out to clarify that the reason why he wants an airplane is not only to get around, but also traveling and monitoring the area in Uruguay, and that's what he said, you know? He said that it's a good business to pay over $1 million for the Hawker 700.
Right. Now, presidents usually don't wait in line at airports, but I remember Uruguay's former president, Jose Mujica, notoriously frugal. How did he get around?
Yeah, he used to get around in commercial flights. I don't know if he made lines. Probably he didn't. But yeah, I mean, it goes hand to hand with his spirit and his way of living, right? Spending less money. But still, I'd like to consider that time, it's a good way of saving money too, you know? So I'd rather have a president maybe flying for 20 hours and working the extra 28 that he didn't fly, instead of flying 48 hours, you know, in a commercial airline. So that's an interesting thing we Uruguayans need to look at, because we're like always criticizing, you know, and maybe we have to do the math before criticizing.
You know, there were some slightly awkward moments for Jose Mujica when he was president, and he would ask neighboring presidents, when he wasn't catching a commercial flight, to hitch a ride to conferences on their planes.
Yeah, I mean, he actually traveled with Mexico President Peña Nieto. His airplane is amazing, and Argentina's airplane is way better than the Hawker 700 that we're talking right now. And yeah, I mean, he actually hitched a ride. That was a cool move, you know. Instead of paying for gasoline or even buying an airplane, he went and said, hey, give me a ride, Cristina. I think it was Cristina back then, Cristina Fernandez. It's probably pretty good for international relationship, especially with Uruguay and Argentina. I'm pretty sure that conversation in those airplanes are probably interesting.
Yeah, would love to be a fly on the wall in one of those cabins. How does the average Uruguayan feel about this? Were many swayed by the thrifty ways of ex-President Mujica and think that Vasquez is asking too much?
I would say that it's half a half, maybe a little bit more trending towards saying no to the airplane, you know? This is something that Uruguayans need to think more. When we spoke a lot about the airplane, it was exactly at the same moment they were talking about raising taxes. So that came really bad. Like, hey, are you raising taxes and you're going to buy an airplane? Are you joking?
Well, I mean, apparently they're not in bad company. There's Costa Rica, Nicaragua, the Dominican Republic. None of them have a presidential jet either. What do you think is actually going to happen? Will President Vasquez get the jet?
That's a question that he only knows. He's probably not smart on my side to say if he's going to do it or not. I have to say that we're going to wait and see.
All righty. Wheels up, Pablo. That's Pablo Zanocchi in Montevideo, Uruguay. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
This is The World. Guilty of inciting discrimination and insulting an entire group of people. That was the verdict handed down today by a Dutch court in the hate crime trial of Geert Wilders. He's an anti-immigration politician in the Netherlands. His party is leading in the polls ahead of elections in March. Today, he denied being a racist in an online video response to the judges who made the ruling.
I am not a racist, and neither are my photos. This sentence proves that you judges are completely out of touch.
My BBC colleague Anna Holligan is in the Netherlands and has been following the trial. So tell us what this verdict means, Anna. Will he be sent to jail?
It was really fascinating today listening to the judges in court. He was charged following a rally in a cafe in which he asked his supporters if they wanted to see more or fewer Moroccans in the Netherlands. And his supporters chanted back, fewer, fewer, fewer. And the judges ruled that those chants were not spontaneous. So Geert Wilders had said, well, these comments are protected by freedom of speech. The judges said, actually, there are limits there and that freedom can't be used to inhibit the freedom of others. And that's why we were in court, and that's why he was found guilty of insulting an entire population and also of inciting discrimination.
We heard his comment that he's not a racist, neither are my voters, he said. Aside from that, what's been Wilders' response to this charge of inciting discrimination, insulting a whole group of people?
Well, you asked the question there about whether or not he would be facing a jail term. The judges said that because he was a politician, the fact that he had been convicted was punishment enough. And actually, the way that Geert Wilders operates as a populist politician, he was one of the first people to congratulate Donald Trump on his victory in the United States. He's a very big supporter. This has played right into his hands. And he also said, in response to the judges, that they had found half of the Netherlands guilty. And the reason he says that is because, according to research conducted, commissioned by his own party, 43% of people in the Netherlands believe that there is a problem with Moroccans. And so he's been able to say, I'm standing trial on behalf of all of these Dutch supporters, and I am prepared to talk about the issues that other politicians are afraid to.
So 43% of the Dutch feel that way. Do you think the trial has actually helped Wilders in terms of publicity?
Well, no question. When I was speaking to political analysts a few months ago, I would ask, do you think Geert Wilders could ever be prime minister? They'd laugh at me. And now it's starting to look like it could be a reality, because today we've heard from the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte saying that he would potentially work with Geert Wilders if he were to take back those comments on Moroccans. And I think the closer we get to these elections in March 2017, the more we are reminded of Donald Trump's victory, Brexit in the UK. And that's a reminder for everyone here in the Netherlands not to take anything for granted, and certainly not to underestimate the power of the populace.
Yeah, it all sounds very familiar. My BBC colleague Anna Holligan in the Netherlands, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
In the wake of our election, worshippers at a mosque in Utah have opened their doors to the non-Muslim community. They're holding Friday night information sessions called Meet the Muslims. Members of the Utah Islamic Center say right after Donald Trump's victory, many of them wondered what their neighbors really thought about them. Andrea Smarden has our story from a suburb of Salt Lake City.
In the entryway, shoes fill the shelves and spill out onto the floor. There are not enough seats for all the people in this little mosque tucked inside a strip mall. In the front, a few rows of men are doing their regular Friday evening prayers. The rest of the room is packed mostly with non-Muslims.
Looks like we have a shortage of chairs.
After prayers, the imam tells the crowd that he's been overwhelmed by calls and cards of support since the election. He presents the basic tenets of Islam and then answers questions. Afterwards, there's snacks and a chance to mingle. There's a mix of people here, some who've never been to a mosque, academics and students, families with children, liberals, as well as conservatives like Ben McClintock. He says he voted third party.
As a conservative, I want to let them know that there are conservatives that don't believe all of the propaganda about Muslims.
And as a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, McClintock feels some solidarity with Muslims. In the 1800s, thousands of Mormons fled Missouri after the governor ordered them, quote, exterminated. So when Donald Trump talks about banning Muslims from the U.S., that strikes a nerve.
I think with our past persecutions and things like that, we're a little more open to the idea of making sure that government isn't given the power to persecute a people.
The Muslims I talk to here feel that Utah is a welcoming place to live, and that Mormons who have traveled the world on religious missions are open to different cultures. Imran Raja was born in Africa and grew up in California before settling down here.
Mormonism and Islam share similar beliefs and practices. Like, we don't drink alcohol, we don't like to gamble, and then we're also very focused on our families. It's been a more desirable place to be as a Muslim compared to other places.
While many Utahns were openly critical of Trump's nomination, a lot still voted for him.
It was an eye-opening.
Taiba Khan is a Muslim born in India and has lived most of her life here.
It's a little uneasy feeling, but it makes you wonder, you know, who is secretly must be hating you.
She's not surprised that Utah would vote Republican, but she doesn't know what motivated those votes.
I mean, we personally even know Muslims that voted for Trump, and it was just because they want whatever establishment gone and, you know, things needed to change. So you don't know the reasons that that really happened. I mean, you're hopeful it's not just hate.
Another Muslim here, Sarah Chowdhury, was born and raised in Utah. She says Trump's election revealed divisions she didn't know were there.
It's just like, we thought that maybe you understood our point of view. So we thought we were okay in that sense.
Chowdhury felt hurt in a personal way.
I actually have a really good friend of mine. She voted for Trump. Her vote was abortion. But underlying factor is that you were okay with that then.
A 7-year-old girl pulls on my sleeve and suggests that I interview her mother.
I'm Allison Schlichter. My youngest daughter is black.
That's Amina, the one who touched my arm.
She's an immigrant, and she has a Muslim name. And I have another daughter who is gay. And people that voted for Trump, I feel, are a danger to my family.
Schlichter, who grew up in New York, is a member of the LDS Church, but doesn't consider herself religious. She's pretty angry at fellow Mormons who voted for Trump.
I feel quite betrayed by them insisting on their religious freedom and then electing Trump.
Her daughter, Amina, says that since the election, she's been afraid she will be sent back to Ethiopia. But this event at the mosque has done something for her.
It makes me feel a lot better because I know that there is tons of people that know how I feel.
Her mother says it's been a lesson for everyone.
One of the speakers up here talked about improving your community by knowing individuals from other walks of life. And I think that's really key. It's a choice to open yourself up to exposing yourself to other people that aren't the same as you.
Most of the Muslims at the mosque had stories of non-Muslim friends, co-workers, neighbors, and even strangers reaching out to show their support. For some, the election was an unwelcome wake-up call, but also an opportunity to come together and talk. For The World, Andrea Smartin, Sandy, Utah.
You are with The World. I'm Marco Werman. She's a Latino rocker with Spanish and Arabic roots. Her name is El Huri, and she's cutting her own path through the music world.
So I'm saying, sigo adelante, I'm moving forward, but I will never forget because I can't go back.
El Huri turns the amp up to 11. That's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There have been so many doping scandals in sports, it's hard to be surprised anymore. But the conclusions of a new report on Russian athletes from the World Anti-Doping Agency are simply staggering. It says more than 1,000 Russians benefited from a state-sponsored doping program between 2011 and 2015, and that the 2012 London Olympics were corrupted on an unprecedented scale by this. The report was written by Canadian lawyer Richard McLaren, and it basically provides the evidence behind the decision to bar many Russian athletes from last summer's Rio Olympics. The BBC sports reporter Alex Capstick has been reading the report. So what are the most dramatic findings, Alex?
Well, I think we won't be surprised or shouldn't be surprised by the fact that all the key findings in Professor McLaren's first report, which was released in July, they've been reinforced here. He's taken more time to go through that, to gather the evidence, and then give us it in plain speak, really. He's saying that, you know, there was institutionalized, centralized doping in Russia over a number of years, from at least 2011 till 2015, that system corrupted the 2012 London Olympics and also the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi on home soil, that home athletes were protected by an elaborate system of cover-ups so that their positive samples would go undetected. And he said that over 1,000 athletes have been involved in this process over those years, which is a staggering figure.
That's a huge number. And the Russians apparently got away with it with some techniques that were pretty shrewd, right?
The example I'll give you is what happened in Sochi when, you may remember, there's a story that test tubes were passed through a small hole in the wall of the anti-doping laboratory to FSB agents, the Secret Service. There's now more information about how they did this, about how they removed these the caps on the bottles, which were supposed to be tamper-proof. And they did it by inserting a very slender piece of metal, which dislodged it and lifted it up. And that's how they swapped the urine. But to make it seem real, to make it seem fresh, they put salt in it to make it the right colour. They even added a little bit of coffee in it to make it seem real. So they went to great lengths to make this cover-up happen.
So they thought about this a lot. You called this state-sponsored, or the report implies it's state-sponsored. How high up did the doping program actually go in the Russian government?
We don't know how high up it went in the government, but it's certainly they're convinced it went as far as the Ministry of Sport.
So these 1,000 athletes, are they mostly in one particular sport or event, or does this scandal extend across a range of sports?
It's around about 30 different sports spread across summer and the Winter Olympics. When this scandal first erupted, it was seemed to be, or it was concerned with athletics, track and field. Professor McLaren's remit was different. He was allowed to look at different sports, and that's when he came up with this conclusion that actually it wasn't just track and field. It was many, many sports. As I say, around about 30 Olympic sports were involved with this.
What is the nature of the investigation now?
His investigation has finished. He'll now pass it on to the International Olympic Committee. They've got a couple of inquiries which have been running simultaneously, and they have been in contact with Professor McLaren. But they will continue with their investigation. They'll digest the contents of the report, and the IOC will then come up with its own conclusions in the new year. It'll be under great pressure, I imagine, to issue Russia with more sanctions. Obviously, they will give the Russians a chance to defend themselves, but if they come up with the same answers, the same findings as Professor McLaren, then many people will be calling for further bans on Russia in the future.
Yeah, as the IOC investigation goes forward, should we expect a number of athletes to have medals revoked?
That's already happening. The IOC has been retesting samples from Beijing and from London in 2012, and many athletes have already lost their medals because they have tested positive retrospectively. I imagine that will continue to happen. It can't happen for Beijing anymore because the 10-year statute of limitations is now over. They can for London. They will for Sochi. They're looking at all the samples taken from Russian athletes at Sochi. We're still waiting for the results of that. So, yes, more Russian athletes, maybe not just Russian athletes, maybe athletes from other countries, could lose their medals if they're found guilty retrospectively.
That was my BBC colleague Alex Capstick. The new doping report really blasts Russia for playing dirty. Here's one of the more devastating lines in the document. The desire to win medals superseded Russia's collective moral and ethical compass and Olympic values of fair play. We reached out to Charles Maines in Moscow to find out how Russians are feeling about all this.
After a full year of doping scandals and, of course, this partial ban on Russian athletes to the Rio Games, I think it's safe to say that nobody expected any good news from this latest and final WADA investigation. So the message out of Moscow today has been largely one of almost prepared defiance. We had the former minister of sport here, Vitaly Mutko, essentially issue a statement before the report came out warning that there was kind of an attack coming. We also had state television here run a documentary that made the argument that top Western athletes are also involved in doping, except that they get these so-called medical exclusions to continue competing. And finally today, we heard some more conciliatory tones from the Ministry of Sport, or what passes for it these days. It was a statement that rejected the doping charges, but said they would be willing to look at the report.
What about the Russian athletes themselves? Have they commented?
Yeah, I'd say that they've been actually much more forthright and emotional. We've heard from people across the board, from all forms of sport. Of course, this applies to over 1,000 Russian athletes in 30 sports. We've heard people impugning the integrity of the author of the WADA report. This is the Canadian lawyer, Richard McLaren, saying that Mr. McLaren essentially was a pay-for-play deal, that he was receiving money to issue these damning reports, which gave him all the incentive in the world to keep doing so. Also, people impugning the integrity of the actual main source for the report. This is the former head of the Russian anti-doping agency here who fled Russia for the United States, Grigory Rodchenko, noting that he was sort of a turncoat. We've certainly heard from people saying that this was a politicized report and it was flatly anti-Russian. That's a line you hear a lot here. Take, for example, Alexei Vovoda. He's a 2-time gold medal bobsled champion at the Sochi Games, and he said that this report was, quote, revenge for Russia's annexation of Crimea.
Yeah, I mean, the implication of all of this is that the West hates us because we're Russian. We heard kind of the same thing from many officials in Russia in July when the first report was released. Is there a sense there that no amount of evidence is going to be enough to assign guilt?
This doping scandal is seen here as just another indication of how the West hates us. I would argue the same thing in terms of the burden of proof. I mean, how do you prove to Russians that their soldiers are in Ukraine? How do you prove that hospitals were bombed in Syria outside of Aleppo? It's all part of this same kind of information war that it's perceived as here. And I don't know that you can prove to Russians per se that they are guilty of these charges.
So does the average Russian buy the government line even after a second report?
Well, I can't say so far. Of course, this report just came out today, and we'll have to see what people's responses are. But just judging by, for example, the coverage on essentially the ESPN of Russia, it's a state-run channel called Match TV, they had a panel of 7-8 people, and not one of them questioned that, well, you know, maybe there's a problem here. You just don't hear that opinion. It's that the fix is in.
Charles, just tell us what kind of pressures Russian athletes actually face in order to perform well and win medals for their country. Do you think every Russian athlete that competes is an image of Putin in his or her mind and thinks, I've got to get a medal for the Kremlin?
I think it's fair to say that sporting success has become a huge part of Putin's success. I mean, if Vladimir Putin's rule over Russia over this past 16 years has been essentially a story of Russia rising from its knees, I would say that the rise of Russian sport back to top form is part of that. Remember, they... back at the Vancouver Games, the Russians performed very poorly. They were a lot of fretting here, officials fired, heads rolled. And then suddenly they retooled the machine and they were doing very well in London. And then, of course, they won top in the medal count in Sochi. So there's always been this kind of link between politics and sport in Russia. But if you go to the athletes themselves, I think there is the sense that whereas a Western athlete is looking for possible sponsorships from companies or some federations of the sport, in Russia, the state is directly involved in the success of these athletes. You know, a gold medal here means an apartment in Moscow, a fancy sports car. It means you're set for life. So I think that drives some of this pattern of doping that we've seen. And that's something that Russian sports journalists will tell you off the record, but they never want to be interviewed about this.
Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We like talking history on the show because the past really helps us understand the present. And today, an anniversary of an event that is all about that. I'm talking about the fall of Jerusalem in World War I. A British-led army defeated the Ottomans to take control of the city. This opened up the entire Middle East to be reshaped by the victorious Allies, for better or worse. Just look at the Mideast today and you can make your own judgment. Here with the story of the fall of Jerusalem is the world's history guy, Chris Wolfe. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Marco.
And it's been recommended that we start with a bit of music to get us in the mood. So here is the London Philharmonic Orchestra with a composition by Maurice Jarre. That, of course, is the theme from Lawrence of Arabia, right, Chris?
That's right, Marco.
So is this story about Lawrence of Arabia?
The British officer who led the Arab revolt? Well, indirectly. He was just one bit player in the British campaign to take Palestine from the Turks. And the real commander of the British forces was a guy called General Allenby.
So this world-changing event, as we've set it up, the fall of Jerusalem, it had less than a glamorous story, right?
Well, that's right, Marco. You'd think that there would be some huge dramatic event that would surround this. Actually, it's a lot less exciting than that. There was a British private, a cook, a guy called Private Murch. Now, this story is recounted by a British officer who was there, a guy called Vivian Gilbert, in his book, The Romance of the Last Crusade. Now, he describes Private Murch as a miserable specimen, a cheerful cockney from London, unshaven, grease all over his uniform from his cook duties, the toe cap of one boot missing, helmet was too small, squashed from being used as a pillow held on by string, but he had a very cheerful, sunny disposition, but he wasn't a very good cook. And when they woke up this morning on the December the 9th in 1917 and found that the eggs were spoiled in the officers' mess, they sent him off with his rifle alone to go to a village a mile east of camp to go get some eggs. He got lost and kept wandering through the mist until he stumbled on a large crowd of people with white flags trying to kiss him and welcome him to their city. And this guy kept trying to give him a set of keys and says, I don't want your city, I just want some eggs. So he goes back and tells his officers what's happened, and they realise, oh my God, the Turks have abandoned Jerusalem. So then they sent a brigadier in and a major general to each get the keys from the mayor, a guy called Hussein al-Husseini. And each time the superior ranking officer says, no, I want the keys. I want to take the keys because I want to be the one who took Jerusalem. And finally, Allenby says, no, I'm going to go and get the keys. So the poor mayor is waiting all day. That takes about 2 days before Allenby finally gets the keys. And then the poor man dies, the mayor of Jerusalem, Hussein al-Husseini, dies just a few weeks later of pneumonia. And Major Gilbert, the author of The Romance of the Last Crusade, suggests that it's probably because he was waiting out in the cold weather of Jerusalem, December, waiting for the cook, the brigadier, and the other generals to come and take the keys of Jerusalem.
That is an extraordinary story. I mean, what were the British doing there in the first place?
Well, Turkey was an ally of Germany in World War I. Obviously, the Brits wanted to defeat Germany and its allies. So they were attacking the Turkish Empire from different directions. One of them was from British-controlled Egypt into Palestine. It was really just a small part of the bigger war.
So Jerusalem, obviously a holy city for the three main monotheistic religions of the world, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. How sensitively did the British handle taking over this very important place?
Well, the takeover itself went pretty smoothly and was actually handled pretty delicately. Allenby was smart enough. He had Muslim troops in the Indian part of his British Imperial Army, and so he used them to occupy the city initially to not give offense to anybody. And then he himself, in a show of humility for the cameras, entered the city on foot rather than on horseback or in a motor carriage, just to show that he was humbled by the responsibility. And in a sense, there was a honeymoon period because it was a time where everyone believed Jews, Arabs, Christians, that their dreams could come true.
So how did politicians mess things up then in the Middle East? How did we get from that to today?
Well, the British goal obviously was to win the war. And so what they had done was to make contradictory promises to different sets of people. Just a couple of weeks before the fall of Jerusalem, they'd issued the Balfour Declaration, which had promised the Jewish people a homeland in Palestine. Local officers, including Lawrence of Arabia, had promised Arabs self-rule after the Turks had been defeated. But the only deal that really stuck was the one that the British made with their main ally in the war, which was France, which is to carve up the Turkish Empire for themselves in what's known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And obviously that laid the foundations for the creation of British-controlled Palestine in Iraq and French-controlled Syria and Lebanon. And obviously, we've been living with the results ever since.
The world's own history guy, Chris Wolf, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
He had white horses and ladies by the score.
The lyrics sound like they might be about a crusader who once rode through the Ottoman Empire, but all composer Greg Lake could remember was that the chord progression gave him the feel of a medieval song, and he came up with the words around that idea. We got the news yesterday that Greg Lake died at the age of 69. He was a guitarist, singer, and songwriter for English prog rock outfits King Crimson and Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. And this song, Lucky Man, he composed when he got his first guitar at the age of 12. As he explained in his biography, he was lucky. He grew up in a poor family, but when he asked his mom for that guitar, she said yes. Greg Lake never wrote down the words to Lucky Man. He committed them to memory as a boy. And years later, when Emerson, Lake, and Palmer put out their first album in 1970, Lucky Man was one of the hits. Okay, for prog rock, it was a hit. It reached the top 20 in the Netherlands. Keep your amps on. A conversation with Latina rocker El Huri. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. For the next few minutes, we're going to hear about a series of beautiful photographs that illustrate a harsh reality many would prefer to ignore. The photographs are by Andrew Morosik and Juan Jose Barboza Gubo. They focus their lenses on the LGBTQ community in Peru. Hate crimes against that community are very common. And as Barboza Gubo explains, those crimes often go unpunished.
If you're gay or trans, or if you're part of the LGBTQ community in my country, and something bad happens to you, you go to the police, and the police do not even pay attention to you. There are all these crimes happening every day, and nobody cares. That's the last thing that they want to hear. And what we are trying to show the community is that this happens everywhere, every day.
Some of the photographs in the series depict places throughout Peru where gay or transgender people were murdered. The images themselves may not be graphic, says Morosik, but they're just one part of the story.
Some are just really beautiful, simple landscapes. We try to make sure that the image itself, for what it is a beautiful image. But the image is sort of heavily dependent on the text and the caption that goes along with it. And for us, I think a big turning point for us was the younger people who were killed. One of the last shoots that we did was in a town called Chachapoyas, which is up in the mountains in northern Peru. And it's about a 9-hour drive up a mountain from the nearest major town. And there a 19-year-old boy was dismembered. He was rolled into a mattress, dumped into a field, and burned. Again, he was 19 years old.
Another part of the series includes portraits of transgender women in Lima. And in these images, some of the women are presented in an almost sacred light. They are literally portrayed as Catholic religious icons. One subject appears wearing a crown of thorns, like Jesus. Others are shown posing as the Virgin Mary. The photographs clearly send a message to the Catholic Church, an institution that has long been openly hostile to gay and transgender people. Or as Morosik puts it,
utilizing their oppressors' tools to elevate them. And for the church to use things like crowns or beautiful capes and veils to highlight people who they would consider saints or the Mother of Christ or what have you, we felt that those objects, they belong to the people. They belong to all of us. And as churches will celebrate saints, we wanted to celebrate these women in that way.
Beyond sending a message to the Catholic Church, Barboza Gubo hopes these portraits will also provide a real-life boost to LGBTQ Peruvians.
I feel that they just live a life surviving. They don't have anything that they can relate to. There is no icon. There is not a hero. So there is something that we are, again, trying to create for them, trying to make them believe that there is something that they can see that is like so beautiful that they relate to and that they want to be like that image.
Photographer Juan Jose Barboza Gubo and before him Andrew Morosik. Their work is currently on exhibit at the Wagner Gallery at New York University. If you can't get there, you can also see some of their powerful photographs from Peru at PRI.org. For the musician we're going to hear from next, there's power in going by just one name. She's a rocker known simply as El Huri. For the record, her full name is Cecilia Villar El Huri. Born in Ecuador, grew up in Manhattan, and check this out. When she was 12, she started a Rolling Stones cover band. She was also playing gigs at CBGB's. Fast forward to today, here's a track from El Huri's latest album. The song is called Nunca Volveré, which means I'll never go back. El Huri stopped by our studios recently to talk about her music. What are you singing about here?
Actually, this is an immigrant's tale.
Mm.
It's about when people leave a country or their home and find that they can't return. So I'm saying, sigo adelante, I'm moving forward, but I will never forget because I can't go back. And it's really dedicated to people that are, you know, immigrants and refugees and all that.
The lyrics in Nunca Volveré aren't a literal take on El Huri's own story, but you can definitely hear influences stemming from her whole family's immigrant experience in the song. So on that, we hear the rock influence, but I kind of hear also some threads leading back to your mother and her Lebanese roots, that kind of convivencia where Arab and Moorish and Spanish sounds all kind of collided in this happy way. So is that where you were going with that?
Oh, absolutely. No question. And, you know, my father's from Spain. Rumba flamenco is in there. And my Arabic side, my mother's side, the Lebanese roots, I was just digging deeply and going there with this song and the arrangements. And I went there and just kept going.
As I hear you talk about your music, it strikes me that it contrasts pretty sharply with a lot of Latin hip-hop and, you know, the reggaeton, which gets so kind of taken away from the roots and the tradition that you start to almost forget exactly where it comes from or what it is. You seem to straddle the past and the present and even a little bit of the future in a very elegant way. Are you kind of a carrier of a torch for the past?
That's so gracious of you, first of all, and gives me chills that you say that. I really appreciate that. I feel like I'm a bridge about everything. A bridge culturally with, you know, being an immigrant, but being fully assimilated. A bridge to different cultures, because that's my roots. A bridge musically. So I guess I live in that middle. And, you know, I love Led Zeppelin. You know, but
who doesn't? But, well, actually, I know a few people don't, but I love. Yeah,
but I also love the clave. So, you know, why can't they coexist? Why can't we cultures coexist? Why can't we, you know, celebrate differences? And, you know, so that's part of my music and my life.
Let's close with your tune El Viento. Tell me about the song.
The song is really an honorary song to like our parents and our grandparents that would go to these great, you know, ballroom dances and things like that of their day. And I don't know, I just felt really deeply into the Latin, the guido and the clave. I also wanted an electric tres, which doesn't exist. So I built this instrument with my great luthier, and he thinks I'm crazy, but he humors me. So I was like, this is a Cuban tres, which is an acoustic instrument, and I want an electric version. So we kind of constructed it.
The album is called La Lucha, El Huri. Thank you very much for coming in. Really lovely to meet you.
Mil gracias para ti.
And that's all for us today. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.